Chapter 75. Don't part with your illusions. When they are gone, you may still exist, but you have ceased to live. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Often, the surest way to convey misinformation is to tell the strict truth. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. We were driven over Sir Colin Campbell's route by a British officer, and when I arrived at the residency I was so familiar with the road that I could have led a retreat over it myself. But the compass in my head has been out of order from my birth, and so, as soon as I was within the battered Bailey Guard, and turned about to review the march, and imagine the relieving forces storming their way along it, everything was upside down and wrong end first in a moment, and I was never able to get straightened out again. And now, when I look at the battle plan, the confusion remains. In the east was born west, the battle plans which of the east on the right hand side are of no use to me. The residency ruins are draped with flowering vines, and are impressive and beautiful. They and the grounds are sacred now, and will suffer no neglect, nor be profaned by any sordid or commercial use, while the British remain masters of India. Within the grounds are buried the dead who gave up their lives there in the long siege. After a fashion, I was able to imagine the fiery storm that raged night and day over the place during so many months, and after a fashion I could imagine the men moving through it, but I could not satisfactorily place the 200 women, and I could do nothing at all with the 250 children. I knew by Lady Inglis's diary that the children carried on their small affairs very much, as if blood and carnage and the crash and thunder of a siege were natural and proper features of nursery life, and I tried to realize it. But when her little Johnny came rushing, all excitement, through the din and smoke, shouting, "Oh, Mama, the white hen has laid an egg!" I saw that I could not do it. Johnny's place was under the bed. I could imagine him there, because I could imagine myself there, and I think I should not have been interested in a hen that was laying an egg. My interest would have been with the parties that were laying the bombshells. I sat at dinner with one of those children in the club's Indian palace, and I knew that all through the siege he was perfecting his teething and learning to talk, and while to me, he was the most impressive object in Lucknow after the residency ruins, I was not able to imagine what his life had been during that tempestuous infancy of his, nor what sort of a curious surprise it must have been to him to be marched suddenly out into a strange dumb world, where there wasn't any noise, and nothing going on. He was only 41 when I saw him, a strangely youthful link to connect the present with so ancient an episode as the Great Mutiny. By and by we saw Cawnpore, and the open lot which was the scene of Moore's memorable defense, and the spot on the shore of the Ganges, where the massacre of the betrayed garrison occurred, and the small Indian temple, whence the bugle signal notified the assassins to fall on. This latter was a lonely spot, and silent. The sluggish river drifted by, almost currentless. It was dead low water, narrow channels with vast sandbars between, all the way across the wide bed, and the only living thing in sight was that grotesque and solemn bald-headed bird, the adjutant, standing on his 6-foot stilts, solitary on a distant bar, with his head sunk between his shoulders, thinking of his prize, I suppose the dead Hindu, that lay awash at his feet, and whether to eat him alone or invite friends. He and his prey were a proper accent to that mournful place. They were in keeping with it, they emphasized its loneliness and its solemnity. And we saw the scene of the slaughter of the helpless women and children, and also the costly memorial that is built over the well which contains their remains. The black hole of Calcutta is gone, but a more reverent age has come, and whatever remembrance or still exists of the moving and heroic sufferings and achievements of the garrisons of Lucknow and Cawnpore will be guarded and preserved. In Agra and its neighborhood, and afterwards at Delhi, we saw forts, mosques, and tombs, which were built in the great days of the Mohammedan emperors, and which are marvels of cost, magnitude, and richness of materials and ornamentation, creations of surpassing grandeur, wonders which do indeed make the like things in the rest of the world seem tame and inconsequential by comparison. I am not purposing to describe them. By good fortune I had not read too much about them, and therefore was able to get a natural and rational focus upon them, with the result that they thrilled, blessed, and exalted me. But if I had previously overheated my imagination, by drinking too much pestilential literary hot scotch, I should have suffered disappointment and sorrow. I mean to speak of only one of these many world-renowned buildings, the Taj Mahal, the most celebrated construction in the earth. I had read a great deal too much about it. I saw it in the daytime, I saw it in the moonlight, I saw it near at hand, I saw it from a distance. And I knew all the time, that of its kind it was the wonder of the world, with no competitor now, and no possible future competitor. And yet, it was not my Taj. My Taj had been built by excitable literary people, it was solidly lodged in my head, and I could not blast it out. I wish to place before the reader some of the usual descriptions of the Taj, and ask him to take note of the impressions left in his mind. These descriptions do really state the truth as nearly as the limitations of language will allow. But language is a treacherous thing, a most unsure vehicle, and it can seldom arrange descriptive words in such a way that they will not inflate the facts by help of the reader's imagination, which is always ready to take a hand, and work for nothing, and do the bulk of it at that. I will begin with a few sentences from the excellent little local guide-book of Mr. Satyachandra Mukherjee. I take them from here and there in his description. He inlaid work of the Taj and the flowers and petals that are to be found on all sides on the surface of the marble evince a most delicate touch. That is true. He inlaid work, the marble, the flowers, the buds, the leaves, the petals, and the lotus stems are almost without a rival in the whole of the civilized world. He work of inlaying with stones and gems is found in the highest perfection in the Taj. Gems, inlaid flowers, buds, and leaves to be found on all sides. What do you see before you? Is the fairy structure growing? Is it becoming a jewel casket? The whole of the Taj produces a wonderful effect that is equally sublime and beautiful. Then Sir William Wilson Hunter. The Taj Mahal with its beautiful domes, a dream of marble, apostrophe rises on the river bank. The materials are white marble and red sandstone. The complexity of its design and the delicate intricacy of the workmanship baffle description. Sir William continues. I will italicize some of his words. The mausoleum stands on a raised marble platform at each, of whose corners rises a tall and slender minaret of graceful proportions, and of exquisite beauty. Beyond the platform stretch the two wings, one of which is itself a mosque of great architectural merit. In the center of the whole design the mausoleum occupies a square of 186 feet, with the angles deeply truncated, so also form an unequal octagon. The main feature in this central pile is the great dome, which swells upward to nearly two-thirds of a sphere, and tapers at its extremity into a pointed spire crowned by a crescent. Beneath it an enclosure of marble trellis work surrounds the tomb of the princess, and of her husband, the emperor. Each corner of the mausoleum is covered by a similar, though much smaller dome erected on a pediment pierced with graceful Saracenic arches. Light is admitted into the interior through a double screen of pierced marble, which tempers the glare of an Indian sky, while its whiteness prevents the mellow effect from degenerating into gloom. The internal decorations consist of inlaid work in precious stones, such as agate, jasper, etc., with which every squandrel or salient point in the architecture is richly fretted. Brown and violet marble is also freely employed in wreaths, scrolls, and lintels to relieve the monotony of white wall. In regard to color and design, the interior of the Taj may rank first in the world for purely decorative workmanship. While the perfect symmetry of its exterior, once seen, can never be forgotten, nor the aerial grace of its domes, rising like marble bubbles into the clear sky. The Taj represents the most highly elaborated stage of ornamentation reached by the Indo-Mohammedan builders, the stage in which the architect ends and the jeweler begins. In its magnificent gateway, the diagonal ornamentation at the corners, which satisfied the designers of the gateways of Itamaduddaullah and Sikandra mausoleums, is superseded by fine marble cables, in bold twists, strong and handsome. The triangular insertions of white marble and large flowers have in like manner given place to fine inlaid work. Firm perpendicular lines in black marble with well-proportioned panels of the same material are effectively used in the interior of the gateway. On its top, the Hindu brackets and monolithic architraves of Sikandra are replaced by Moorish carved arches, usually single blocks of red sandstone, in the kiosks and pavilions which adorn the roof. From the pillared pavilions, a magnificent view is obtained of the Taj Gardens below, with the noble Jumna River at their farther end, and the city and fort of Agra in the distance. From this beautiful and splendid gateway, one passes up a straight alley shaded by evergreen trees, cooled by a broad, shallow piece of water running along the middle of the path to the Taj itself. The Taj is entirely of marble and gems. The red sandstone of the other Mohammedan buildings has entirely disappeared, or rather the red sandstone which used to form the thickness of the walls, is in the Taj itself overlaid completely with white marble, and the white marble is itself inlaid with precious stones arranged in lovely patterns of flowers. A feeling of purity impresses itself on the eye and the mind from the absence of the coarser material which forms so invariable a material in Agra architecture. The lower wall and panels are covered with tulips, olanders, and fulbin lilies, in flat carving on the white marble, and although the inlaid work of flowers done in gems is very brilliant when looked at closely, there is on the whole but little color, and the all-prevailing sentiment is one of whiteness, silence, and calm. The whiteness is broken only by the fine color of the inlaid gems, by lines in black marble, and by delicately written inscriptions, also in black, from the Quran. Under the dome of the vast mausoleum, a high and beautiful screen of open tracery in white marble rises around the two tombs, or rather cenotaphs of the emperor and his princess. And in this marvel of marble, the carving has advanced from the old geometrical patterns to a trellis work of flowers and foliage, handled with great freedom and spirit. The two cenotaphs in the center of the exquisite enclosure have no carving except the plain calamdanar oblong pen box on the tomb of Emperor Shah Jahan. But both cenotaphs are inlaid with flowers made of costly gems, and with the ever-graceful Olander scroll. Bayard Taylor, after describing the details of the Taj, goes on to say, "On both sides the palm, the banyan, and the feathery bamboo mingle their foliage. The song of birds meets your ears, and the odor of roses and lemon flowers sweetens the air. Down such a vista, and over such a foreground rises the Taj. There is no mystery, no sense of partial failure about the Taj. A thing of perfect beauty, and of absolute finish in every detail, it might pass for the work of genii who knew not of the weaknesses and ills with which mankind are beset. All of these details are true. But, taken together, they state a falsehood to you. You cannot add them up correctly. Those writers know the values of their words and phrases, but to you the words and phrases convey other and uncertain values. To those writers their phrases have values which I think I am now acquainted with, and for the help of the reader I will here repeat certain of those words and phrases, and follow them with numerals which shall represent those values. Then we shall see the difference between a writer's ciphering, and a mistaken reader's, precious stones, such as agate, jasper, etc. 5. With which every salient point is richly fretted. 5. First in the world for purely decorative workmanship. 9. The Taj represents the stage, where the architect ends and the jeweler begins. 5. The Taj is entirely of marble and gems. 7. inlet with precious stones in lovely patterns of flowers. 5. The inlet work of flowers done in gems is very brilliant, followed by a most important modification which the reader is sure to read too carelessly. 2. The vast mausoleum. 5. This marvel of marble. 5. The exquisite enclosure. 5. Inlet with flowers made of costly gems. 5. A thing of perfect beauty and absolute finish. 5. Those details are correct. The figures which I have placed after them represent quite fairly their individual values. Then why, as a whole, do they convey a false impression to the reader? It is because the reader, beguiled by his heated imagination, masses them in the wrong way. The writer would mass the first three figures in the following way, and they would speak the truth, total 19, but the reader masses them thus, and then they tell a lie, 559. The writer would add all of his 12 numerals together, and then the sum would express the whole truth about the Taj, and the truth only 63. But the reader, always helped by his imagination, would put the figures in a row one after the other, and get this sum, which would tell him a noble big lie. 559,575,255,555. You must put in the commas yourself. I have to go on with my work. The reader will always be sure to put the figures together in that wrong way, and then as surely before him will stand, sparkling in the sun, a gem-crusted Taj tall as the Matterhorn. I had to visit Niagara 15 times, before I succeeded in getting my imaginary falls gauged to the actuality, and could begin to sanely and wholesomely wonder at them for what they were, not what I had expected them to be. When I first approached them, it was with my face lifted toward the sky, for I thought I was going to see an Atlantic Ocean pouring down thence over cloud-vexed Himalayan heights, a sea-green wall of water 60 miles front and 6 miles high, and so, when the toy reality came suddenly into view, that barreled little wet apron hanging out to dry, the shock was too much for me, and I fell with a dull thud. Yet slowly, surely, steadily, in the course of my 15 visits, the proportions adjusted themselves to the facts, and I came at last to realize that a waterfall 165 feet high, and a quarter of a mile wide was an impressive thing. It was not a dipper full to my vanished great vision, but it would answer. I know that I ought to do with the Taj as I was obliged to do with Niagara, see it 15 times, and let my mind gradually get rid of the Taj built in it by its describers, by help of my imagination, and substitute for it the Taj of fact. It would be noble and fine then, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.